expression that pinched her face and told me what I had already begun to suspect. Alice knew. Perhaps not her name, and perhaps not even with any real certainty, but she knew that John was involved with another woman. Somewhere, however deeply she may have buried it, she knew. Alice blinked and asked, "Who?" I shook my head, ignoring her feigned expression. There could be no more hiding, I told myself, no more pretending. My voice was stronger, sharper, as I told her, "You know who she is, Alice." She looked taken aback, but whether at my tone or my words, I was uncertain. "I don't know," she protested. I leaned forward. "You do." "No," she said, backing away. "I don't know. I don't want to know." She looked up at me, her expression pleading. "I don't want to know, Lucy. Alice." She began to shake her head then with such force that I moved toward her, worried. "Alice," I murmured, trying to keep my voice low and steady. Her face was red, her cheeks streaked with tears. "I know," she said, the words sounding like a gasp hanging in the air between us. "I know, Lucy. It's all so horribly embarrassing, but of course I do." I exhaled, certain in the knowledge that I had been right, that I could still read her, that I still knew her, just as I once had. "What do you think he'll do, Alice?" I continued. "When he finds out that you know, when he realizes that the money will stop." She remained silent, her eyes wide. "You know what we have to do, then?" I pressed. "We have to leave, before he realizes."
"Realizes what?"
she whispered. "That you know as well." She was silent, and so I whispered, "There isn't any other way." I was no longer certain if she was listening. She was shivering violently, though it was still warm, the humidity evident in the trail of mist on the glass windows. She wrapped her arms around her body as if to protect herself against the cold, and I felt myself shiver as if in response. "We'll go back to Tangier tomorrow. We'll tell him together, and then we'll leave," I whispered, my voice steady, calm.
"Yes,"
she whispered, turning toward the window. "Isn't that what you wanted, Alice?" I asked her. "To leave Tangier? To go back home?"
"Yes. Yes, of course,"
she replied. I felt my heart flutter, felt the realization that now was the time to move, to declare. I stood and leaned forward so that I was only inches from her, my face hovering above her tear-stained skin. And then I kissed her. Before him, we had been inseparable. But that year, our fourth at Bennington, something changed. Alice began to spend less time in our room, always making her way to and from the photography lab, or into town, arranging to see Tom whenever she had the opportunity. I would often catch sight of her as she bounded across the open lawn and toward the parking lot, headed to the warm interior of Tom's waiting Skylark. It was easy to spot, a deep red that gleamed in the sun, its outline shimmering against the pale, more conservative cars of the faculty. It was a wonder that anyone as young as Tom could afford such an indulgent vehicle, since most auto shops were still clinging to wartime rules, requiring several months down payment before anything could be driven off the lot. I felt the resentment begin to prickle, hot and sharp. Tom Stowell. He was, I soon learned, from an old family in Maine, not the side filled with fishermen and carpenters, but the one full of colonial houses and lobster bakes every summer Sunday evening, one built on old money, which meant that what little of it still existed was tied up in the house, or whatever they could borrow based on their last name. As a legacy, he had received a full scholarship at Williams College. Without it, there was no hope of the Stowell name being represented within the walls of any respected educational system in New England. Some of this information I had gleaned from Alice herself, though she was surprisingly secretive when it came to Tom, and gathered the rest in various ways, including from other students at Bennington. It turned out that the girls knew everything about the boys at the next college over, had made it their business to know their future husbands. For although the girls majored in literature and mathematics, a few even claiming pre-med, the vast majority of them, it seemed, had already realized that their only profession was destined to be wife and mother. It became my business to know everything there was about Tom Stowell, what classes he took, the other boys he counted as friends. I received such information eagerly, as if I were dying of thirst, as if their whispers and rumors were the only water in the world that would quench it. The car, I soon learned, had been a 16th birthday present from his grandfather, the Stoic patriarch. My studies began to suffer, but I didn't mind. Tom was my major now, and my life, my happiness, depended on knowing everything about him. In the absence of Alice, I retreated to my old haunts, spending afternoons in the library, convinced that she would soon tire of him, that one day she would simply return, walking through the hardwood doors, smiling, her arms stacked with books. The previous months would fall away then, dissipating as if they had never happened. I watched, and I waited, patiently, knowing that Tom's time was running out. And when at the end of each day she failed to appear, I would head home, shivering, winter falling fast and quick, wondering if I would ever feel warm again. To keep her near, I began to borrow pieces of her wardrobe, a scarf, a pair of stockings. Each and every one of them seemed to carry something of her scent, a mix of spice and floral, as distinctive as any perfume. I had once pulled on one of her outfits, the fabric stretching and straining, refusing to be malleable, to my initial disappointment. I reminded myself then that Alice and I were not the same. We were each of us separate and distinct, only whole when placed together. Dressed in her clothing, her scent reminded me of this and worked to still my mind, if only for a brief moment. But then she had walked in. I had felt my cheeks burn with shame, so that I had hastily clawed at the dress, feeling the seams as they pulled and gave way. And on her face, I could see the astonishment, and something else, horror, I realized at finding me like that, dressed in her clothing. And though she reassured me that it was fine, that I could borrow them any time I wanted, I only sagged beneath her words. She had not understood, had carelessly attributed my actions to vanity alone, not thinking, not realizing that it was all only in order to be closer to her. Afterward, I had felt the need to be cruel, to punish her, consumed by the desire for her to know what it was like to be lower, inferior, to be held at the whim of others. She had done it to me time and again, without so much as a second thought, and I wanted in that moment for her to know what it felt like. And then one day, Alice reappeared in our room, held out her hand to me, and everything else fell away. A small rose-gold band with a minuscule diamond gleamed back. I looked up at her and asked, "So, it's all been decided then?" My voice distant, so that I was convinced that I could hear it echoing throughout the room. "Almost," she said, smiling. "There's nothing official yet, but we plan to have the ceremony sometime after graduation. After that, Tom's going to take me abroad." There would be no Paris, no Budapest, no Cairo. Not for us. I had shaken my head then, had told myself no, I would not be made to go back, to return to my dull little life, a life of obscurity, of mediocrity. She was the one who had dragged me forth from the shadows of the library, from my own mind, and I, in turn, had helped her to dispel the shadows, helped her to move on from the anxiety that had gripped her since the death of her parents. It was all so plainly obvious, but somehow her vision was obscured. She could not see that Tom Stowell could not care for her as I would, that he did not understand her. She needed I realized then to be reminded. And so, I smiled and offered my congratulations, and I started to plan. I pressed my lips against Alice's own, the movement so familiar from the hours I had spent thinking of it, at times convinced that it would never come, and I waited for a response, for an indication, for anything that told me what she was thinking, feeling. And then, yes, I was certain I felt Alice respond, felt her body shift and her lips open just slightly. Closing my eyes tighter, I worked to put everything into that one gesture, all the longing and dreaming that I had done in the years since we had first met, the pain of our year-long separation, and the hope I now had for the future. Later, in our bedroom, I turned to her and smiled. It's fate, don't you see? After everything we've been through together, I said, my voice dropping to a whisper. That night with Tom and the accident. I saw her flinch, but I pressed on, knowing that this too was something she could no longer ignore. I thought you would never survive, not when the brakes had been cut. And then I saw you, and I was certain that you were dead. I was sure of it. But then you weren't, and I stopped, noticing her face. She had gone pale, her eyes boring into my own. I watched her, waiting for her to speak, but she only remained silent. I glanced at the window, the traces of humidity obscuring most of what was once there. I could no longer see Alice reflected back, only my own strange face as it peered at itself.
Chapter 9. Alice. She had nearly fooled me. In her presence, I had allowed myself to forget about the horrible past, the tedium of the present, and the depressing future that any fortune-teller worth a grain of salt would be able to read in my sad, shattered palm. I had closed my eyes in the back of that beaten-up taxi, allowing my body to be flung one way and then another as we bounded over the dips and around the curves of Morocco, letting the wind and the sand whip across our faces and forgetting that it all existed. I worked my way back to that place, before everything had gone so spectacularly wrong, when all I had felt was determination and hope, and the knowledge that the future would be whatever I made out of it. And it had almost worked. For a few heart-clenching, wonderful hours, so absolutely pure and beautiful that I felt at times that I could not breathe for the joy of it, I had managed it all. I dug out my camera, taking photographs. I smiled into the faces of strangers. I laughed at the kindness of children. I stood face to face with the unknown, and I only wanted more. And so I ate and I drank until I thought I would burst from it. I laughed until my muscles ached, until my limbs grew heavy. And then the facade came shattering down around me, breaking and splintering around my bare feet, and I knew that it could never be put back together again. She had whispered to me about John's infidelities, reminding me of knowledge I already had possessed, though I had worked to bury it deep. She had convinced me that I must leave Tangier, that we must leave Tangier, in secret, under the cover of night, because she also knew about the money, about the allowances passed from Maud to me and on to John, knew about what he would really lose with my absence, and I did not question how, knowing only that she must, in that way that she always knew everything. It had all made a perfect sort of sense, and so I nodded and agreed. Tangier was not mine. I had never laid claim to it, nor it to me. I knew that I could leave and not be too bothered. But then she had mentioned the accident. She had said the word, Tom, magic in its incantation, dispelling everything all at once, bringing it to light, so that I had no choice but to look at it again, once more. I had not wanted her to say his name. I had not wanted us to be forced to confront, to remember. I had wanted to continue as we were, if only for a little while longer. But then she had said his name, and the spell had broken. She had said the next words, ones that were never mentioned in any newspapers, by any police officer, not even by Maud, because I had never mentioned it, had never told them what had happened in the span of those last minutes, tucking it away and keeping the information to myself, knowing that voicing it aloud would not change anything, could not change anything. Aunt Maud had told me weeks later, when I started to come out of the shock, when at last I could sit and listen and eat again once more, that there was little left of the wreckage, just burned up bits and pieces that the police had done their best to sift through, though they had never arrived at any official answers. In the taxi ride home the next day, something pulled at my memory, and I struggled to bring it to the forefront. I thought of the few stories she had told me about her family, her father, about the garage that he had worked in, and I felt as though the air had been ripped out of me, as if my lungs no longer worked. I struggled to breathe, the space between Chefchaouen and Tangier fragmented and blurred, so that I remembered nothing, nothing at all except what she had said, what she had whispered, lying in bed, the rain slanting down the rooftop, loud and insistent, so that for a moment I thought I was mistaken, had hoped that I was. But I wasn't. I knew. I had heard her correctly, had heard what it was that she had said, her breath hot and moist against my cheek, as she had smiled and sighed, and leaning toward me, whispered his name, whispered about that night, whispered about the breaks. When John greeted us upon our return, watching from the threshold of the doorway as Lucy and I made our way one slow step at a time back up and into the flat, I did my best to rearrange my face, to inhabit some semblance of the person I had been before we left. I mounted the steps with something like dread, the knowledge of what I had learned pressing against me so that I could no longer foresee the future, could no longer, in fact, see past one step and then another. As we came into view, John called out to me,
"What on earth are you wearing?"
I looked down, tugging self-consciously at the blouse and running my hands nervously over the pleats of the trousers, eager to be rid of them both. "I borrowed them from Lucy," I said, blushing as I said her name, as if that night was something etched into my face, as if John would only have to look in order to read everything that had happened, that had transpired between us. His face rearranged itself into a frown.
"What happened to your own clothes?"
"They got dirty." I knew my voice sounded short, curt, but there was nothing that I could do to change it. I felt as though all the energy had been leaked from my very bones, that the effort I had made all these months to smile and nod my head, to act as though I had not made an enormous mistake in coming to Tangier with him, had suddenly left me. It was no longer possible.
"Dirty?"
he laughed.
"What on earth from?"
I heaved a loud sigh.
"Does it matter?"
John looked momentarily taken aback. Finally, he said,
"No, I suppose it doesn't."
He gave a shake of his head and stepped aside to allow us into the apartment, followed by a quick jibe about his surprise at finding my note, although it was clear that what he really meant was displeasure. Running his fingers through his hair, he attempted a light-hearted laugh, but I could feel his eyes searching out mine, wondering, speculating, puzzling over whether Lucy had managed to pass along his little secret. He did not realize that I had already known, that he was not the only one who could keep things hidden.
"Maybe you should take a bath," he said, his voice hollow. "You're covered in dust."
He laughed again.
"And in those clothes, people will start to wonder."
I looked at him, eyes narrowed.
"Wonder what, John?"
A dare, just there, beneath my words.
"I don't know," he said with a touch of defiance. "But not anything good, I suspect."
I wanted to respond, to snap, but the words stuck in my throat, and then the moment was gone, along with the insinuation. In the silence came John's insistence that he didn't mean anything by it, that he was just on edge, worried by my absence. And there did seem to be a truth to it. His eyes were red and swollen, as though he hadn't slept the night before. I felt ashamed then, for snapping, for being angry at him for something he knew nothing about. I began to tell him this, but he had already moved on, suggesting drinks, suggesting that we go out, visit a jazz club, that promise he had made the first night, and which now seemed like ages ago. His enthusiasm for the outing, I suspected, built upon the prospect of keeping an eye on us, of monitoring what was and wasn't said. I wondered why he even cared now that he had someone else. Or perhaps he meant to try and keep us both. Sabine, that was what Lucy had called her. It would not have surprised me. I felt Lucy's gaze, hard and insistent as always, demanding me to speak, to set our plan, no, her plan, I reminded myself, into motion. I stood, feeling the intensity of both their gazes upon me, and I felt for a moment that I might burst, shatter into a million pieces right in front of them. The idea filled me with something like pleasure. I ground my fingernails into my palms. "I'll just take that bath first," I said, trying to make my words light, though they seemed to resound throughout the room, heavy and dull. John had been right. After our long drive home, Lucy and I were both filthy, covered in dirt and sunburned, our bodies peeling and flaking with each move. I moved quickly from them, feeling their eyes on my back. Once behind the closed bathroom door, a long, heavy sigh escaped me, and I wondered if they could hear me, wondered whether they, both of them, were listening from the other side of the door. I ran the water, sitting on the edge of the tub's ceramic shell, letting it develop into a scorching heat, not caring but rather welcoming it, the moment my sunburned skin would turn an angrier shade of red. I lowered myself under the water, grateful that it muffled the sound of my scream. And when I resurfaced, when I at last felt the air enter my lungs, burning, I coughed and sputtered and feared that I might retch from the force of it. She had done it, and I had always known. That was what the fog had hidden from me. But I remembered now, remembered how in the days afterward I had been convinced that she had been the one responsible. But when I had tried to say it, first at the hospital and later in England, Aunt Maud had brushed aside my accusations, had told me instead to be quiet and still. And because I was not entirely certain, because I was never entirely certain when it came to Lucy, when it came to the dark recesses of my own mind, I had listened, closing my eyes to the possibility. I thought of Chefchaouen, of everything it had stirred within me, both good and bad and frightening, and I was furious with Lucy, with myself. I turned the water spigot farther to the left, willing the scorching heat to burn away the thoughts circulating in my head. I would tell her that I knew what she had done, and then I would make her leave. I shut my eyes and willed myself to be brave enough, smart enough this time, to ensure that she left, and not just Tangier, but my life as well. There could be no more reappearances, no more unexpected knocks on the door. I needed to cast her out, to purge her from my life, once and for all. I had done my best to forget it, to bury it, to move past it. I had married John. I had moved to another continent, hundreds and thousands of miles away from the place that reminded me of him, of Tom. But now I knew that the past truly never was past, and that I could not outrun it forever, that the fog would not always protect me. I felt it begin to resurface then, every painful detail of that time, so that I could no longer feel the heat of the water, of Tangier, pressing against my skin. I shivered, suddenly feeling as though I would never be warm again.
Chapter 10. Lucy. We walked through the Ville Nouvelle district in silence. As we moved, I felt almost instinctively that the space was somehow outside of my jurisdiction, as if those other places in the city, the Medina, the Casbah, and all the twists and turns that existed between them belonged to me entirely, while these streets continued to remain unknown, refusing to yield their secrets. Instead, I felt as if I was on John's territory. And there was something else, too. An uneasiness as a result of Alice's silence, so that Chef Shaoin seemed all at once far away, and I found myself unable to read her, to understand why she had not told John about our plan. Why, instead, we were following him through the streets of Morocco, an unsettling scavenger hunt where none of us knew the prize.
"One other stop first,"
John said, turning down a darkened alley that I did not recognize. "Oh, John," Alice began. I could tell Chef Shaoin had taken its toll on her. Dark circles had appeared under her eyes, and although she had spent time in the bath before we departed, it looked as though some of the sand and peeling skin still clung to her, as if she had made no real attempt to scrub them away at all. "Maybe another night."
"Don't be like that," he said, laughing.
He tugged at Alice's arms playfully, though there was something urgent in his movement, something insistent and desperate. I was reminded of Alice that first night, the way she had smiled and laughed, the falseness behind it, and the sinking feeling that it would inevitably all come crashing down around us, the shards splintering onto the ground. John had that same manic look in his eyes, I thought. But where I had felt concern for Alice, I felt only unease under John's wavering temper. He turned from us then, increasing his speed so that he walked in front rather than next to us.
"Hurry up, we're almost there,"
he called, the sing-song lilt in his voice making it seem like we were playing a game, as if this was all in jest. I thought of the Pied Piper leading the children out of the town and into the forest. And although I knew the fairy tale version that children were told, I was reminded of the much darker telling, where the man, in an act of revenge, led the unsuspecting children to their deaths. But instead of directing us out of town, John ushered us into one of the city's many anonymous bars. It was stained and weathered, the inside intentionally dark, so that it hid whatever refuse the light may have illuminated. I wondered aloud why John had chosen to bring us here, but he only ignored me, walking farther into the belly of the place, until at last it seemed we had come to the end and we were going to continue out the exit. John came to a halt, sending us both crashing into him.
"Here,"
he said, indicating the floor.
"Take off your shoes and leave them."
I frowned, looking over at Alice, but if she was startled by John's game of follow the leader, she did not show it. Instead, she bent down, undoing her kitten strap heels and letting them fall onto the grime-covered floor. I watched her in surprise, and then, realizing there was nothing to do but push on, I undid my own, placing them in the corner, hoping that they would not get trampled in my absence.
"Good."
John beamed at us, looking over his shoulder.
"Now follow me."
I was the last to enter the back room, and it took a few moments of rapid blinking to adjust to the dim light, so that by the time I took in our surroundings, a floor mat of some sort, not quite bamboo, not quite wood, walls so deeply stained with tobacco that in the dim light I could not make out the color, and finally, a few low tables around which a handful of men in traditional jalabas sat, smoking from pipes. John and Alice had already claimed one of the low tables and were sitting, cross-legged beside it. I quickly joined them.
"It took a fair amount of convincing to get you in here,"
John said, his face serious, though his tone was self-congratulatory.
"This is what would amount to an old boys' club here, so strictly no women allowed. You're both in luck that the owner of this joint owes me a favor. Still, I promised him no more than 15 minutes, a half an hour tops."
"And what are we doing here?" I asked, eyeing the other men in the room. Most of them appeared to be well into their 50s, maybe 60s, and though they had turned to us with interest upon our arrival, a majority of them had already looked away, rejoining conversations that had stalled and picking up their slackened pipes.
"This,"
John said, producing his own pipe, one that had apparently been stashed somewhere within the folds of his suit until then.
"You aren't afraid, are you?"
he teased, waving the kiff pipe nearer to Alice's face. His smile seemed to alter, turning small and mean. Not the Pied Piper, after all, I found myself thinking. More like the big bad wolf, tempting us off the path. It felt as though he wanted to poke, to prod, to turn us upside down and see what would fall out. He was nervous, I realized, of what I had told Alice about Sabine, of what perhaps had happened between us. I could see it. His suspicions, his paranoia, shimmering in the air around us. Alice extended her hand and dutifully inhaled the smoking pipe, only to then cough and sputter, much to my amazement and John's apparent delight. I hesitated when it was passed in my direction. While I had always liked cigarettes, from an early age when I had stolen my first pack from the corner shop and ridden my bicycle down by the creek to smoke them, this was something different. I pursed my lips, trying to decide whether or not it suited me, trying to decide what it was that was happening, the night already taking on a strange disorder that I could not figure out, could not reassemble into something familiar and known. John, meanwhile, laughed loudly. "There now," he proclaimed, snatching the pipe back from me. "That wasn't so terrible, was it?" I tilted my head, not entirely sure who the words had been directed at. And soon it was as if they had never been spoken at all. In fact, it was all becoming rather muddled. The drink we had sipped back at the apartment before heading out, and now the kiff, all of it crowded and confused my mind. It began to seem as though we had been sitting there for an eternity, and yet I was certain that very little time had passed at all. I decided then I didn't like it, if only for the way it seemed to swallow time whole. And yet I felt strangely emboldened, sitting in our strange circle of three. I thought of the words I wished to speak, prepared, I thought, to voice them at last if Alice would not. I looked over at her to ensure that she felt the same, and found her slumped in the corner, her eyes glassy and distant. I wondered whether it was the kiff, or whether she had looked like this before, and I had somehow failed to notice. I felt then as though the air had gone out of me. I stood, moving quickly toward the back door, leaning my body out and into the night sky. I inhaled deeply, slowly, grateful that the sun had already set, that some of the humidity had begun to leak out of the day. I grasped my head, willing it to stop spinning, to stop moving so swiftly. I glanced back at the table. Alice remained still, like stone, I thought, impenetrable. John, sucking determinedly on the pipe, looked up and caught me staring. I tried to read what was there behind his eyes, but then he blinked and rose from his seat, asking, "Shall we go on?" I heard a general chorus of agreement, though I had not spoken a word. Still, we followed him, Alice and I traipsing after him once more like schoolchildren. Neither of us asked where we were headed. We only continued to walk, silently and obediently, our heads both bowed as we concentrated on the unleveled road beneath us, careful not to misstep in the darkness. We had walked for some time in silence when John disappeared through a hidden doorway. It was darker than the place we had just left, so I stumbled a few times before finding a place to sit. On stage was a group of older men, sitting in a semicircle, though the music they were playing was decidedly not jazz. Even my uninitiated ear could distinguish as much. Instead, a blend of Arabic and Andalusian music emerged from the instruments held by the men, their voices occasionally adding to the melody. They played often together as a collective, and then there were moments where one of them paused and the others took over the music, each one seeming to anticipate the rhythm and flow of the other. I watched as one of the old men used this interlude to produce a kiff pipe, tucked unceremoniously in his back pocket until then. The old man inhaled, a second or two stretching out into three or four. I noticed the look of annoyance that passed over John's face. "Wrong night, I suppose?" I asked him, fighting to keep the smirk out of my voice. he ignored my comment.
So,
he proclaimed instead, looking back and forth between the two of us as if deciding what route to travel down, whether to give in to the desperation or to cling to the illusion, the falsity that everything was fine, that everything would continue to be fine. I looked away, not knowing which one I hoped for. Despite John's jubilant tone, there was something hard, something rougher than there had been before.
Alice finally left the flat.
The words hung among the three of us, John looking back and forth between us as if anxious to see who would respond first, who would rise to his bait.
"Don't be absurd,"
Alice said, reaching for her drink and taking a deep gulp.
"I'm not a recluse."
Her voice was low, so that I had to lean across the table in order to make out the words. She seemed dulled, harder, so different from the lively creature she had been only the night before. I struggled to understand what had changed.
"Yes, well, I must admit I was surprised. I wondered at first whether you hadn't just headed back to England,"
John observed, his smile wide, his eyes bright. He let out a laugh.
"Oh, my little Alice in Wonderland, what on earth am I going to do with you?"
"Don't call me that,"
she whispered, though her voice was largely lost in the din of the noise. John turned to look at me then, his eyes moving up and down, taking in my appearance. A blouse and trousers once again, my unfashionable long dark hair pulled back into an equally unfashionable plait. I could read the disappointment on his face.
"What on earth should I do with her?"
he asked, his gaze locked onto my own. A million responses flitted through my mind, the very first among them, "Let her go." I didn't say it, though I could feel the words forming on my lips. Instead, I turned, breaking his gaze, and reached for my drink, anxious to feel the warming calm of the gin. There was silence for a moment, and then John said, turning to me,
"Say, isn't your little holiday about over by now?"
He leaned back in his chair, swirling the ice cubes in his drink.
"Surely it's nearly time to return to the real world."
He laughed, though I could see the glint in his eye. He meant it as a slight. I could feel it in his words, his resentment for my relationship with Alice boiling over the dips and curves of every syllable. I saw her, too, the slight flinch, the quick intake of breath. She had heard it as well, had felt it. After all, that was the point, for his words to insult, to cut, to tear, to wound. I would never really fit in, never really be one of them. That was what he was trying to say. Those girls from good families, those effortless girls, the ones who woke up with long, blonde, shiny hair, pale, nondescript features, an aquiline nose that spoke of wealth and good breeding, girls who did not have to work for their supper, who only had to look first to Daddy and then to their husband. I was different, marked out. My engagement with work an enduring testament to the differences that separated and ultimately divided us. My friendship with Alice was something that John could not understand, but more than that, it was something he did not like. I could see that now clearly. I had tainted her, altered her, or his perception of her, at any rate. Our friendship was a detriment to her character, something that he wished to expunge. I had not bothered him at first, the strange woman who had turned up at his doorway, independent, alone. Those meant two different things, I knew. One could be alone, but entirely dependent, like Alice. She was alone at Bennington, she was alone here. She had always been dependent on someone, her aunt, John, even Tom, for a brief period of time. I was another species altogether, one that had not roamed the same circles as John McAllister. He had been intrigued at first, delighted even by the woman sitting on his couch drinking gin. Now he was angry, unamused by my continued presence, and perhaps most importantly, he was threatened. I smiled, my lips stretching tight against my teeth. For For a moment, I thought that I tasted blood. Actually, I said, feeling the full effects of the night, my mind loosening, my words slipping easily from my tongue. I've no real world to return to, as it happens. I resigned from my position at the publishing company. I noticed how Alice frowned at this piece of information. I hadn't meant to tell her, not until we had left Tangier, but perhaps it was best that such a secret came out beforehand. Yes, I felt like I could see this admission working to my advantage. After all, there was no longer anything tying me to the States, to New York. Together we would be able to go anywhere. John nodded, sipped his drink.
So what, you were hoping to find work here in Tangier?
He raised his eyebrows as he spoke, as if the notion were ridiculous, as if he had never heard of such an outlandish idea.
I don't think you'll find many publishing companies. Besides, won't your family miss you, so far from home?
I felt Alice stir. Lucy hasn't any family, John. I've told you that, she said, a distinct edge evident in her voice. He nodded.
Sure, I remember now, only...
He stopped, turning to me.
Only that's not entirely true, is it?
He gave a quick laugh.
You see, I did a little digging. I know,
he said, turning to Alice, who had started to protest.
I shouldn't have an abuse of power and all that, but I like to know who's living under my roof.
I was still, waiting, wondering what it was that he had managed to unearth, what skeletons he would drag out of the closet and into the light. He paused, waiting as well. His grin, his laugh dragged out for full effect, as to emphasize his greatness, his perceived triumph over the woman who had threatened to best him. And Alice. Alice was watching me. I could feel it, feel her gaze burning, hot and accusatory. She was the one to speak first, her voice small, trembling.
What did you find?
Oh, nothing too interesting in the end. A struggling lower-class family, a tiny flat above a garage, an absent mother and father. Nothing too unexpected. I suppose that's the better turn of phrase.
But,
Alice began.
Do you know, it's strange, I sometimes think,
John said, interrupting her. What is? I asked.
This whole situation. You here in Tangier. How you showed up uninvited.
His words were coming faster, spit starting to gather in the corners of his lips. The sight made my stomach turn, and I looked away in disgust. Alice wanted me here, I said, my voice steely, loath to answer his accusations, but anxious to defend myself nonetheless.
No.
I turned. It was Alice who had spoken. She hadn't shouted. Not exactly, but the word was loud and drawn out. It seemed to echo in the space around us, despite the presence of numerous bodies. It was as if we were the two of us alone, as we had once been, rendering John's presence uncanny.
No,
she said again, quieter this time, as if she could not quite believe in the word itself or what it stood for.
No, I didn't, Lucy. I never invited you.
She held my gaze.
I never wanted you here.
She whispered, the last word all but lost in the noise around us, so that I was not entirely certain it had actually been spoken. Alice stood, sending our table off balance so that the drinks we had ordered swayed precariously, threatening to spill. I watched, my eyes riveted to the swaying glasses. In truth, I could not bring myself to look up at her to see what was written there after what she had said. When I finally did, it was only to see the back of her disappearing through the front door of the bar. I snuck a quick glance at John, surprised to find that instead of the smirk I had expected to see, he only sat, his face long and drawn. I wondered whether it was confusion or something else reflected there. He did not make any movement to chase after his wife, but instead pulled out his kiff pipe. I waited for the space of a moment, counting under my breath.
Hundreds of locals were singing, waving banners in the air, but this wasn't a protest. That much was apparent.
People danced and laughed, clapping one another on the back as if in congratulations. I could feel it, the pulse of the city pumping through them, through me. For one wild moment, I wanted to crouch down onto the ground, to lay my hands on the road and to feel the murmur, the beat of it against my skin. It was as if the city knew. Things were happening, finally, after all this waiting. I could feel it tingling in my hands, watching as the people moved around me, locals, expats, tourists, travelers. I wanted nothing more than to follow, to be swept up in it, to move and continue moving and never stop. But then I remembered Alice. A sharp, distinctive wail cut through the night. The noise I knew that the women in Tangier made in celebration. Ululation, I had learned, my mouth delighting in the dips and curves of it. In front of me, I saw Alice a few paces ahead, her arms wrapped around her waist, just like the night before, and yet the temperatures had not yet abated. The heat, despite the sun's absence, still lingered in the air around us. I could feel the sweat pooling at the base of my throat, in the small of my back. "What is that?" Alice asked, lips trembling as I approached. "It's nothing," I said, though I was uncertain whether she could hear me over the noise, whether she would be able to hear me regardless, the look on her face unreachable. I looked around for John, unsure whether he had followed me out of the bar. The voices were beginning to grow louder, and there was chanting now, though I could not make out the words. Fewer foreigners dotted the streets. The wail started up again, and I saw Alice shudder. "It's horrible," she cried. "Why won't they stop?" "It's just to do with the celebration, Alice," I told her. She looked around, her eyes scanning the crowds. "It sounds like someone is dying." "They're not, I promise," I said, reaching for her. She let me pull her forward, and together we began to move again, though her steps were heavy, as if she were walking through mud. There was no expression on her face, and yet somehow this absence seemed to fill her so completely, so entirely, that it crowded her features. I moved to speak, to ask her about what she had said in the bar only moments before, but something stopped me. A hand on my shoulder, and I turned, my heart racing, expecting it to be John. Instead, Yusuf stood, watching. I shrunk back, wondering how he had managed to find me, how, in fact, he had ever managed to find me in the continued disorder and confusion that was Tangier. I fixed him with a stare, my mind flooding with distrust, and I felt all of it then. The strangeness of the night, the uneasiness, the anger, and I hated him. For intruding, for interrupting my moment with Alice, for jeopardizing my chance to make things right. I cast a weary glance over my shoulder. Alice did not seem to notice Yusuf's presence, but instead continued to stare blankly ahead, her eyes taking in the chaos that surrounded us. I felt his hand on my shoulder again, and I grimaced under its pressure.
"I worried after our last conversation," he said, his voice low and insistent.
I blinked. Our conversation. About John, Sabine, it seemed as though it had happened weeks ago. Months, even. I thought about how much had changed since then, and how much more everything was about to change again. I remembered what he had said, "girl," and how I had reacted. I blushed, the anger slowly seeping from my veins, grateful that the night hid the red creeping up my cheeks. Perhaps I had acted with haste. It certainly seemed so now. And yet, the words sat badly with me still, leaving an acidic taste in my mouth.
"You've been avoiding me," he said.
Something inside me grew still, quiet. He squinted through the darkness.
"I cannot think why, but it is quite clear that you are,"
he said, moving toward me, closing the distance between us. I took a step backward. He sneered, as if reading my thoughts. You are all the same in the end. Tangerines. Every Moroccan you see is for personal gain, for sale. He stepped closer. I wonder, mademoiselle, what exactly you are willing to pay, he said, reaching for my wrist, his fingers clasping my skin, hard, pinching, and what precisely it is that you are wanting to purchase. I wrenched my arm away, and in the process collided with Alice so that she fell to the ground, a cry escaping her lips. In that moment, I forgot Yusuf and his menacing tone. He was only a mosquito, I told myself. It was time at last to flick him away. I turned my back to him completely and helped Alice to her feet. Are you hurt? I asked, brushing at her skirt, her knees, both of which were now caked in grime and filth. Alice, I started again, but John appeared then, had already started to make his way back to us. His hair, now sweaty and limp, clung to the sides of his face, his hat nowhere to be seen.
I've got to head to the office, he said,
standing, his arms hanging limply at his sides, as if the frantic energy that had pushed him forward only moments before had drained away, leaving behind only a shell. He stopped, taking in Alice's disheveled appearance. She fell, but she's fine, I said. John hesitated. Then he nodded, his eyes taking in the street revelers that flanked us.
It appears Tangier is done, at least as we know it.
He wiped the sweat from his brow, and I saw so clearly his love for the country, for this strange little stretch of land that belonged to no one and everyone. I saw how much it pained him, the thought of it changing such that he would no longer be the one in charge, but rather the outsider, perhaps for the very first time in his life. He felt powerless, trapped, unable to do anything. And though it pained me to think that we could be at all similar, that any sort of connective tissue existed between us, particularly after what he had tried to do that night, I had felt that before too. Felt it, in some ways, every day of my life. I tried to take pleasure in the fact that now he would feel it as well, but the thought only hit hollow and empty. Has something happened? I asked, unsettled by the change in his demeanor.
Everyone is getting anxious.
He shrugged, though his face conveyed his worry.
What with all the riots in the past few years, they don't want to be around when things are made official.
He shook his head, his expression weary. Tired, I thought.
I have to go. I'll be back later, though I've promised Charlie that I'll head to Fez with him later tomorrow.
He said, speaking the words to Alice, who still did not appear to be listening. He turned back toward me.
Please get her back to the flat.
He hesitated.
And be safe.
And then he was gone, lost in the crowd. I woke in the middle of the night, gasping for air. At first I was unsure of what it had been, a nightmare that had snapped me back to life or a noise from somewhere within the room. My heart beat fast, and I felt a sort of confusion cloud my mind, as exhaustion made it impossible for me to recall where I was and what had happened. Tangier. It came flooding back to me. I was in Tangier, with Alice. And then I saw her, standing at the threshold of my bedroom. In that moment, there was nothing I wanted more than for her to cross the barrier between us, for her to walk into the room, for her to crawl into the small bed, the same one that she had made up for me and that had smelled like her and now smelled of both of us, for her to allow me to comfort her, to care for her. It was a realization that I had come to years ago on the very first day I had met her. That there was no one who would look out for her, that would love her, that would take care of her better than myself. I had waited for her to realize this over the years we lived together in Vermont, tripping happily through the months, wrapped in a cloud of our domestic bliss. There had been picnics, eaten on the lawn and at the end of the world, on sunny spring days.
There had been walks around the campus in fall, crunching leaves under our feet, spending afternoons locked away inside the library. And there had been winter, her favorite season, and mine too, because of how much it made her smile, how much it reminded her of being a child, of being a daughter. We stayed inside by the fire, sipping tea and cocoa. I would always check to make sure the wood had been delivered to our house, and if not, would place a gentle reminder. I knew how much she enjoyed watching the flickering of the flames as the snow fell outside. And that final year, when the stability of the life we had created together was threatened, I had taken care of that too. I had done all of it for her, silently and without complaint. I was happy to do it. I wanted to do it. I did it all, waiting until the day when she would notice, that she would realize. I remained quiet, patient, waiting for her, as always. But then she spoke, her words cracking the darkness in half. "I want you to leave, Lucy." My heart stopped. My stomach clenched. I thought of all those terrible clichés I'd read in books my entire life, and I felt and understood every single wretched one in that moment. I shook my head, trying to shake Alice's words from my mind. This was not how it was supposed to be. This was not what was supposed to happen. I frowned, turning it all over in my mind, trying to make sense of it. How everything could have changed and I had somehow failed to notice in the space of only a few hours. I felt the anger, hot and sharp, pressing at my throat. She had already agreed to go with me. She had already promised. "You mean John wants me to leave?" I finally managed, my words short, clipped. "That's what you mean to say."
"No, Lucy."
She stood tall and erect, as if her confidence, her resolve was bound up in her posture, so that I wanted nothing so much as to push her to the floor, to dispel whatever it was that was forcing her to say these awful things. She crossed her arms.
"I want you to leave."
I sat up in bed, tossing the covers aside. "You don't mean that," I said, my voice I knew wavering between placating and harshness. Her words had unnerved me, unmoored me, so that I could no longer figure out what I was supposed to be to her in that moment, could no longer read what she needed me to be. I shook my head.
"You can't mean that, Alice." "I do, Lucy," she said, nodding, the movement sharp and succinct.
"I don't know what else he said to you," I began, "but you can't let him do this to us." For a moment she looked confused. Then she shook her head again, this time a small smile accompanying the gesture.
"No,"
she said softly, raising her eyes to my own.
"No, this isn't John."
A laugh, sharp and bitter, escaped her lips.
"This is me, Lucy. Entirely me. I'm the one asking you to leave. I'm the one who wants you to go."
She stopped.
"To go and never come back. I want you to leave me alone."
My insides crumpled. It wasn't John, she had promised, but I wanted to reach out and shake her and scream, "Of course it is. Of course it's him." She was too lost, too far under his spell to be able to see it clearly. "Alice," I began. She held up her hand, as if to physically impede my words.
"We were going to leave,"
I argued, moving out of the bed and toward her.
"You had said that we were going to leave. Him, Tangier, all of it."
"No, Lucy, you said. You decided." She shook her head.
"Alice," I reached out for her.
"No."
She stepped back into the hallway.
"I should never have opened that door. I should never have allowed you in."
She started toward her bedroom door, then stopped.
"I know what you did. At Bennington. I know it was you."
"Alice," I started,
"why did you ask me to stay?"
I frowned, startled by the question.
"I don't understand."
"That day, that awful day in Vermont, she said, her voice cold and hard. You told me not to get into the car. Why? Because, I said, looking away only for a second, but she had noticed. I didn't want you to leave. I didn't want us to be angry with one another any longer. No, she said, shaking.